Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Hi, this is Adam Barrett.
Hi, this is Chris Stoppelman.
And welcome to another edition of Speaking of Reliability. Chris and I, we were just having some fun talking about the issues with data and data gathering.
Yeah, well, in our last mastermind meeting, it triggered the thought of, the challenges around getting good field data. And I think we were talking about if you're trying to set reliability targets or try to figure out how to improve your design, it's always good to start with an existing design that's in the market that you can get field data on, because that's always the best data to use. It has the end user use conditions, and you should be able to get a lot of data that way that you just can't replicate in the test lab. So I've always found lots of challenges around getting good field data.
Yeah.
And I thought we could chat about that a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, even having a legacy product in the field, it's not a free ride, because it's still, unless a lot of, preemptive work was done to ensure that data is being collected and is valuable in the sense of being able to turn into information, it still can be quite a challenge, which is just more incentive to, implement these programs. I always feel like what catches people is that they try to, within a product development program, create the data acquisition system. And doing a task like that requires too much resource and its own ability to navigate itself to be a part of a product development program. I don't know if you agree or don't, but I feel like that's kind of a pretty tough struggle to try to do that as a product's being developed.
Yes, and usually those databases are managed by completely different groups that are not so much involved with the product development process.
Right.
So
right.
You may even not know who's working on it or who to contact. So you got to find that out too.
Yeah.
And then I find one of the challenges is these systems were designed and the processes were designed to make the customer happy as quickly as possible. And that sometimes means there's no time for troubleshooting in the field. We just give them a replacement black box, plug
right.
it in, it works again, customer's happy.
Right.
And then what happens to the part that fails?
Yep.
And if you're lucky, you're getting it back in the lab for failure analysis, but
yep.
more often than not, it gets recycled or thrown away.
Yep. Well, I call that, you're contaminating the crime scene, right? Like any good detective, the first thing they do is rope it off, and protect all the evidence. And for, as you're describing, it's the opposite. We go in there and just rip apart everything and try to make it all look like it never happened as quickly as possible. And it's right. And without a good system for, preserving it, it's very likely that the information you need will be lost, and it'd be a very difficult root cause process.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we called it Sweptronics.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how do you go about getting good field data? I would say one approach is go talk to the people that administer the field process or the field service process. Talk to those folks and show them the importance of actually getting more data and more information on the failure, even just what they observe when they go to the customer side. What was the state of the unit that was affected? What did the use environment look like? And capture those things and preserve as much evidence as you're saying as possible, and get that back to us, because it will also help us make the customer happy, and that the next iteration of that product that we design will be better and improved based on the feedback that we're getting.
So, but then the thing is, you're asking for resource. So how do you connect, the value of it to the people who can give permission for the resource? Do you have to tie it to past painful issues and to you know, I guess, you know, the first one that comes to mind is, okay, so there's a previous legacy product that had an issue and it took us 7 months to figure out what was wrong. And the data we collected had these issues with it and didn't really get us there. So we ended up relying on a lot of in-house experimentation, you know, that kind of a thing, building that case and putting a dollar value to it versus if they had had clean data to analyze, they might have been able to figure out what was going on within a week or two, as opposed to creating their own data in-house and then studying it.
Yeah, I think you're giving a good example there. If you had to spend months and months of time and resources in the lab, you know, that's a significant dollar figure versus somebody taking a picture on their phone that doesn't cost a whole lot of time and collecting a little bit more evidence and just making sure they fill the form. So I take a little bit more care in filling out the reports, the field reports, or the service ticket that they're putting in.
But how can the other thing too is how you incentivize that, right? You have the guy in the field. What's his incentives? And I've seen everything across the whole spectrum. And you know, one that sticks out in my mind is, you know, a customer I've worked with, and we're now working very hard to improve their data system. But they have product that's out there in the order of hundreds of thousands of units, and sometimes the installation or handling of the units in the field is a subcontractor of a subcontractor. So it's not their one of their employees, and it's not even somebody their employees directly connects with. Sometimes it can be twice removed because it's physical. These are items that are out in the physical wilderness, basically, we'll say. So it's relatively basic, you know, as far as interacting with installation and removal, and requires more of the outdoorsy type than the high tech trained lab technician type. So they found out actually that some of them are incentivized and paid by how many units they do, which pretty much means if you just go out there and start ripping units out and replacing them, you're going to make more. You know, like, that's not a good incentive system, because it's like, oh yeah, while I'm out here on this call, I'll just replace four others, you know, and what kind of a data set is that? It becomes garbage very quick. So that's, you know, analyzing not just a system, but the way all the pieces interact with each other can be a big deal, where if you changed it to them, they have to fill out a complete form with full details of observations, like you said, picture and all that, and that's what you get paid for. That's different, right? That's paying for what you want.
Yeah, that's exactly true, and that is a challenge, and I completely agree with you. You have to set the incentives in a way that it incentivizes the behavior that you're trying to achieve.
Yeah. I mean, I'm describing an example that is a bit negative, right? It's implying not having not good intent, but and that's an extreme. But even the best intentions, if the structure of the program is wrong, will incentivize the wrong thing, which is kind of the what you brought up first, right? You're saying if the objective for the guy who wants to do the right thing is to get the customer up and running as fast as possible, and that's what's important and he's told is important, that's not the same thing as collecting good evidence. That takes time and slows you down, right? So, you know, it doesn't have to be somebody who's not a team player. Somebody who's the greatest team player following the guidelines you've set may be, you know, effectively creating a data set that then is very hard to use. So, yeah, it takes a very conscious, you know, group of people coming together and to really look at all the aspects associated with all the things that happen between the failure and the data getting back, and creating a system that ensures and, you know, and incentivizes people's actions to, you know, to make it the set that you can trust.
Yeah. And a lot of times you have a lot of additional pressure from your customer. If we're talking about a high volume manufacturing operation, and you just, that your machine just caused them to grind to a halt. You know, they're going to be standing right behind you, looking over your shoulder or yelling at you to get that machine back up and running. So there's another disincentive to do detective work at that point in time. And you just want to make them happy or make them go away and fix the machine and get it back up and running, or whatever part you're working on. Yeah. And yeah, the in that instance, it would take somebody that would kind of say to the customer, yeah, I understand. But if I take another 15 minutes here, you know, we can improve our product to where this failure mode won't happen again. And in the long term, you're going to have better uptime or performance of your system. I don't know that that will necessarily fly, but that's one approach I could think of.
Yeah. All right, we're going to take a quick moment here for a break and we'll be right back.
Hi, it's James Kovacevic here from HP Reliability. I encourage you, if you haven't had the opportunity yet, to download our free ebook on A Smarter Way of Preventative Maintenance. You can find that at ascendoreliability.com/go/PM. If you have any questions, need help with your current PM program, please don't hesitate to reach out at info@hpreliability.com. Thanks.
Back. So Christy, I was talking about how to do it, you know, even especially when the customer is pressuring you and right there. And it's actually funny when you said it, I had a flashback to an experience I had early in my career where there was an issue with our product over in Germany in a very intense situation. So I flew out they put me on a plane. I was out there the next day and the facility in Germany there. The person that on the customer side who was dealing with this was notorious for being rather difficult. And I had no idea. When I was there, he literally stood behind me while I'm trying to, you know, root cause this whole issue. It took me 3 days to figure out what's going on. So he basically like stood over me for 3 days and he would come in and he'd be like, my car gave me a hard time this morning. It's an American car. You know, like that kind of stuff. Like really, like, I was like, Jesus, dude, whose side are you on? Give me a break. I'm trying to solve this, you know? It doesn't go any quicker if you make me cry or whatever you're trying to do.
So. Right. He probably, I would imagine he had the pressure from his manager to get that machine up and running as fast as possible. So that's his mission, was to make sure that you get it up and running as fast as possible. Exactly. And I guess he was probably just venting his frustration with that.
Yeah. Like I'm trying my hardest. It was funny, but, did figure it out though, which was good. And, I ended up actually grabbing parts from like a local hardware store there to try out the idea of how to fix it. And, when I left there, they were running on some garden parts basically. Until we went back and engineered and sent the fix, but, it was a true duct tape and, you know, pocket change and paper clips kind of thing that got him up and going again. So.
Well, good.
That is another interesting aspect too, is the customer's role in it. And I think people can also preemptively establish a relationship with the customer to have them be a very positive role in all of this, because they are consistently on the ground, you know, boots on the ground, so to speak, at the front line. And if you preemptively, I think, engage them in a way saying, hey, you know, this is our first generation of this product, or these are big changes in this. And, you know, to have a quick time to market, we are, you know, going to be monitoring data very closely as we release, because we believe there'll still be some maturity at that point. We'd love to engage with you and have you help us with it. This is a system we're going to use. And, you know, they might actually get excited about that, you know, as well, and having that kind of close relationship and being a part of it. And they might really appreciate the fact that you're so conscious of that you are ensuring the product's mature, and you could end up kind of getting this, you know, really, really the best possible, you know, colleague in doing this, as opposed to, you know, somebody who's there and is monitoring the product and because they're using it. So I think there's a lot to be said.
There's definitely great value in having that relationship with your customer or with your supplier, you know, going in either direction. Building that trust. I think as a customer, you get the best benefits because you might get the latest and best technology. If you help your vendors improve their technology by giving them feedback, you know, you end up with a much better product that way.
Right. Exactly. And then you also, you know, to reciprocate that, you can, you know, offer them things that are kind of exclusive, right? As far as compared to other customers, you're obviously going to be much more willing to share really cutting edge advancements you're doing with them because of this relationship, where you know that they understand, you know, and if they want to participate in being part of, you know, of the development process, they're going to get access to technology that your other customers may not. So it's probably definitely something good to kick around, you know, internally to departments to see about, you know, trying to formulate, you know, a way to introduce that to your customers. Because that obviously has to be pretty well thought out, because you're kind of opening up in some ways some of your inner workings to them potentially.
Yeah, it has to be a part of a long-term strategy and a long-term alliance with your customer or supplier, depending on which way you're going. And you can't do that with an organization that's always looking to get the best price on a product by, you know, playing different suppliers against each other. And so you don't want to have, it's not going to be possible to have that kind of relationship with a customer like that.
Yeah. That's very different for sure. So now, as far as data sets, you know, that we've actually, you know, dealt with, what's one of the more difficult ones you've had to deal with to try to extract information out of it?
We had to revive an old server and retrieve a database that was no longer in use to get warranty data that was up to 30 years old.
Oh my God. It's way crazier than I thought you were going to answer.
And it was fun. The IT department was very helpful.
Do you know what that's called? Wait. Do you know what that's called? That's called archaeology. That's not data retrieval.
I thought it was part of reliability engineering.
No, that's archaeology. That's Indiana Jones stuff right there.
Yeah.
You found the server. Revived the server. The Covenant Ark.
Yeah, so I didn't, but yeah, the IT folks did. And I finally got to the data. We found the table we were looking for and were able to extract the data and kind of do some long-term warranty analysis on a comparable product to what we were developing. And that was it was actually good to see, and because we were giving a long warranty on our parts, on our product. And it was good to see that past product was performing really well long term as well.
So that's really interesting, though, that a data set from 30 years ago would be relevant to decisions you're making now in a product, you know, development program. How did that correlation come about?
The product hadn't changed that much. Materials had, but the general composition, the types of parts you have in there hadn't. And so, of course, it didn't tell us with new processes and new materials and new designs being part of that product exactly what the performance or reliability was going to be. But it gave us an indication of, you know, we did this right in the past. And although there's the risk we built them more conservatively in the past than we do now as we're trying to cut costs out. So you don't want to assume that you have the same reliability now. On the other hand, materials improve too. If you're talking about plastics, you know, they have improved over the last 30 years.
Yeah.
It was more of, I was really curious to see, do we have any type of data for the reliability of our product?
Yeah. One of the more difficult ones I've had was, it was one that there was tons of data, you know, tens of thousands of data points. And it was the data was initially offered as having, you know, been filtered and sorted, you know, where it had, you know, the right flags in it to try to find relationships between different factors. And every time we analyzed it and looked at it, the team that provided the data was like, oh, wait a minute, maybe that could be this. We can resort it for this, you know, and then we'd do it again. They'd be like, well, do you know what? Actually, I think that this and this might not mean that, so we should resort it for that. And it was like iterations of that, to where you just felt like, you know, the next iteration, like, why don't we just not do this one until they come back and tell us again that they, you know, like, why, you know, let's just wait until. So it was this whole thing of this difficult process of them discovering what the data meant and being able to assess and, you know, adjust for all the assumptions and knowns and unknowns, and having effectively what I call the scrubbing process happening mixed in with the analysis process. It just made it so miserable and difficult. And that it really showed how important it is to have a very formal scrub initiative before the analysis initiative, where, you know, kind of leaving it to, oh, we'll figure it out as we're breaking it down. Just, you know, that just, it just doesn't work very well.
Yeah, I've definitely been there on a couple of occasions, and it's actually been fun starting just with a big data set, and you don't even know where you're going. You kind of have an idea what you're trying to learn, but as you're digging into the data, you're discovering new things that make you look at the data differently. And I don't know if you can decouple it the way you described it, that, you know, you scrub it first before you analyze it. I think you have to do some analysis to figure out how to scrub it.
Yeah.
Or what's contaminating it.
Yeah. You're right. It would be very difficult to have it be as clean cut as I described. Or I should say that to have it be as clean cut as I described, it would have to be some iteration later of having done it before, where effectively, like you're saying, the analysis process that shapes the scrubbing process has happened. Because, you know, we're coming back to the same type of thing again. Oh, we know how to scrub this now, you know. So you're right. It really does probably mixing the first time you do it with that type of data, the scrubbing and analysis would be mixed in together.
However, I'm thinking back to times when I used huge Excel sheets to do this kind of data analysis. And these days, there are so many better big data analytical tools that you could use, or there are groups within the company that use them, that you could probably do it all in one fell swoop, you know. But if you're sitting in front of Excel, you have to you have to do a few iterations until you start seeing the light. It's my experience.
Yeah. Oh, good. Well, it looks like as far as the time goes, we try to keep these down to where our listeners, even with the shortest commutes, can listen to a whole episode. So I think we'll stop here. We definitely covered some really good stuff. And thanks, Chris. I'm glad we got a chance to record this conversation. And
yeah,
it was really good. It was definitely some interesting stuff. We both got to bring up some good war stories, I think.
Yeah, thanks, Adam. Always a pleasure.
It was good. All right, well, thank you, everybody, and for listening to this episode of Speaking of Reliability. And like always, we hope to see your comments. Take care.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.